This is Martha Rosen on Friday, February the 12th, and I'm speaking with Judge Abel Wolk in Sarasota, Florida. We'll try to include the information about his parents and family and how they arrived and settled in Pittsburgh.
My mother's father's name was Morris Rosenthal.
Go ahead.
He left Suwalk, which was in Poland, but at the point, the city was at the corner of Lithuania, Germany, but it was in Poland. My father came from that same city, but my grandfather, he left in 1858, and I think he went to England first before coming to America. Then he came to New York City. He was a young man with a wonderful personality, and he enlisted in the Civil War, and he was wounded in the Battle of the Wilderness. He was married in New York City, and my mother was born in New York City. Then he came to Pittsburgh and became, looking for a position, he became the first policeman, Jewish policeman, in the history of Pittsburgh.
How did he happen to come to Pittsburgh?
Don't know.
You don't know? All right, go on.
But
that's very interesting.
Came to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So he became the first Jewish policeman,
and the
family remained in Pittsburgh.
And he was the first Jewish politician.
Go on.
He had such a wonderful personality and would do a favor for anybody who was in trouble, that he became known as the King of the Jews in Pittsburgh.
What was your mother's family name? This was your mother's father.
My mother's father. What? Rosenthal.
A Rosenthal.
Rosenthal.
And what was his first name?
Morris.
Morris. Rosenthal. Mm-hmm. All right.
Here is a very interesting thing. It's not off the record.
My
father came to Pittsburgh in 1879, he became a peddler.
That's in there. Mm-hmm.
And he was arrested for not having a license. And a friend told him to see Morris Rosenthal. He didn't know him. And Morris Rosenthal took care of the matter. And he became the first, Morris Rosenthal became the first president of the Beth Medrash Gadol Synagogue, which later was, the synagogue was built on Washington Street, and he was president.
Mm-hmm.
So he really built the synagogue.
When did your parents get married?
Huh?
Do you want to talk about when your parents married? Or do you want to lead up to that?
You're going to read this.
All right.
Afterwards.
Yes.
You're going to read this.
Yes.
Yeah. My grandmother, who died very early after I was born, when my mother died, the president of Beth Shalom Synagogue came to the house and he said, I want to tell you a story. When we came to Pittsburgh, we were very, very poor, and Mrs. Rosenthal would visit people that were sick, and my wife was pregnant with her son. I made a mistake. He was the president of the bus show.
Who the son was?
The son was.
Oh, the son became president.
Well,
all right, we can correct that.
Yeah. And he told this story. He says, Mrs. Rosenthal visited my wife, and when she left, I saw a $20 bill on the floor, and I picked it up and said, Mrs. Rosenthal, you lost $20. She says, no, I didn't. I didn't lose any money. That was the way she gave charity.
Beautiful.
That was my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's enough for my
During this section just recorded, Judge Wolk referred to some material he had given me to read. This was an interview he had granted at the request of Dr. David Kurtzman. The University of Pittsburgh wanted to have a history of the Pittsburgh Renaissance for the Pitt Library. So Dr. David Kurtzman at Pitt, being a highly regarded close friend of Abe Wolk, sent an interviewer to Mr. Wolk because he, quote, knew all about Pittsburgh, quote. This was the only interview Judge Wolk says he granted before this present one. Now, Judge Wolk asked me to record the interview, which contains a great deal of the information regarding Mr. Wolk's involvement, influence, and accomplishments in Pittsburgh's development. And since Mr. Wolk is now over 90 years old, it appeared sensible to follow his request and use other interview energies for more personal material. So I shall record the following interview, which took place on April 26, 1973, when a gentleman named Gary Walters, W-A-L-T-E-R-S, interviewed Judge A.L. Wolk for the Pittsburgh Renaissance Project. Quoting Mr. Wolk, I would say the main ones in the Renaissance were Richard K. Mellon, David Lawrence, and myself. I saw it all. Long before Dick Mellon, or before Lawrence became mayor, or before the Allegheny Conference on Community Development came into being in 1943, I already had the smoke control ordinance enacted into law, and I already had been discussing the School of Public Health. Mr. Walters suggests that they begin by talking a little about Mr. Wolk's background, particularly in terms of his early work in Pittsburgh. So Mr. Wolk continues, I was born September 3rd, 1891. I'm not sure whether I was born on Wiley Avenue, where the Carlton House garage is, or on Federal Street, which is now Fernando Street. My father came to this country in 1879, and he came to Pittsburgh right afterwards. He was a peddler. He told me that he used to walk or sometimes get a ride from Pittsburgh to Ligonier and sleep in barns, pedaling all along the way, the same way he used to go to Uniontown, where Mrs. Thompson was one of his best customers. That was a terrible life, and it affected his health, he claimed later. He came back and went into a small business. Then later he became the first wholesale men's clothier in Pittsburgh and the first to be down on Fifth Avenue. He had his store opposite Old Chestnut Street, which is now Hooper Street. He was a very learned man, not only in Hebrew, but secularly. He was a terrific reader all his life. He died at the age of 89. He became successful, but he always felt he wasn't in good health. So in 1902, he sold his business. He was worth $129,000, which was like $1 million today. We moved to New York, where he invested all his money in the stock market, and unfortunately, the requirement of collateral was very liberal through a bank friend of his, and he also bought on margin. By 1905, I don't know whether he was insolvent or not, but he couldn't pay his rent. Do you know who our landlord was on 71st Street? Douglas Robinson and Theodore Roosevelt and Elihu Root built a mansion 3 doors from us on Park Avenue. My father's landlords permitted him to leave without settling the rent, and he later paid them back in full. He came back to Pittsburgh and took a job for $25 a week, this man who had amassed such a large sum of money in 1905. He lived on Viceroy Street and paid $35 a month rent and had 7 children. My mother used to cut up an apple to give her children. That's how poor we were. But my father was such a smart man that as the years passed, he learned from his mistakes in the stock market. And by 1929, I wouldn't be surprised if he was worth $500,000 in stocks. But he got caught in the crash too. But this time he wasn't wiped out, and he was able to hold on. My mother was the most unselfish and the most kindly person that ever lived. She was involved in all Jewish philanthropic work before we went to New York and when we came back. When we were poor, she still got back into philanthropic work. We moved to Bluff Street after some years, and that's where we lived when I went to college, to Columbia. I'm a graduate of Columbia College, and I had 1 year of law at Columbia and 2 years at Pitt. I couldn't afford to finish law school at Columbia because of lack of money. Even at Columbia College, I was a little short of money. My father gave me $600 for the year, so I had to help out. When I was attending Columbia, I used to go over the hill of Morningside Heights in order to have dinner where I could get it for 25 cents. I became a lawyer in 1915, and I went out for myself and was able to make both ends meet. And when the war came, I enlisted as a second-class seaman. I was at Norfolk Naval Operating Base, and as a young lawyer, I was doing the most menial things a human being could do, carrying a side of beef on my shoulders one day, shoveling coal or gravel on other days. All of a sudden, I saw one day that they were going to have classes in the Blue Jacket Manual and trigonometry for those who wanted to study so they could take the examination to go to an officer school. So I went to the place where the first meeting was being held, and the first day there were 250 men in the room, and the officer in charge says, "Does anyone know anything about trigonometry?" I raised my hand and said that I took trigonometry at Columbia and I made 100%. And I had refreshed myself before coming in the Navy because I wanted to be an officer. He said, "Well then, do you think you could teach the class?" And I said, "Yes, I could teach." So I became a teacher. So then I took the examination and went to the officer school and became an ensign. After my active Navy duty, I was in the Naval Reserve for 4 years. After the war, I came back here. Pittsburgh was always the dirtiest city. It had the reputation everywhere as being the smokiest city in the country, but that didn't make any impression on me in those early days. Mr. Walters asks, when were you first aware that some major changes were needed? And Mr. Wolk replies, when I came back from the Navy, I was active just like my mother. To give you an example, the Montefiore Hospital was up in the Hill District. It was a small hospital, and my mother had a lot to do with it. They wanted to build a new hospital where it is now, but the rich people weren't interested. There was a doctor named K.I. Sains, who was on the West Penn Hospital and the Montefiore staff, and who was the finest surgeon in Pittsburgh. And my father was his first patient when we lived on Fernando Street downtown, and I had the greatest regard and affection for this man. So we had a silent campaign, and we raised pledges of $700,000. Then we went to the rich people and said, now here, if you don't want to help build it, we're going to build it ourselves. But they went along, and we had a terrific campaign. I was always active in every campaign, not just Jewish ones. I was active in the campaign for a children's hospital, too, which was not Jewish. But in all Jewish things, I was very active. To get back to the Montefiore campaign, after we had all the pledges, a story appeared in the paper that it was going to be a University of Pittsburgh-connected hospital. Dr. Sains was very much opposed to it at that time, and I had great affection for him. The controversy became so bitter that each side appointed 7 men. This was never made public, this story that I'm telling you, and I was one of the 7 on Sains' side. I.W. Frank, worth $25 million, had his relative from Harvard Medical School write an article on how wonderful a university connection would be. It may have been true, as you will see later. So the 14 men met on a Sunday morning at the Concordia Club, and the conversation became so bitter there wasn't a chance to achieve a solution. So finally, A.C. Lehman, the chairman, said, well, it looks like we're going to have to give all the pledges back. We won't build the hospital. When I heard that, then I got up for the first time and spoke. I said, I'm going to be very frank with you. I haven't got a really strong opinion one way or the other on this subject, but I have so much affection and regard for Dr. Sains that if I have to vote, I would vote with him. But why is this necessary? We haven't got the hospital, we haven't even got the brick and mortar yet, and you're talking about a university-connected hospital. Let us build the hospital first. Then in 5 years from now, or 10 years, I don't know how long it will be, when we've solved our problems — there were problems peculiar to Jewish doctors, they couldn't get into other hospitals — when we've solved those problems and have achieved success in hospital administration, then bring up the subject of a university connection. It may be a wonderful thing. One of the rich men got up and said, I think Mr. Wolk is right. We shouldn't decide it today. Let's build the hospital first. And one by one, they all agreed. I'm the only one alive of the 14 men. They built the hospital. It took more than the time I said, but now the hospital is a university-connected hospital. Our discussion was back in the early 20s. I'll skip then to when I got into politics. That was in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt campaign for president in 1932. I was caught in the Depression, although I had some money and I wasn't broke. I wasn't a great lawyer, but I was able to make a living, and I could save money, too. I got married in 1928, and I took a 76-day honeymoon to Europe, so I wasn't broke by a long shot. Well, business wasn't as good as it used to be, so I decided to become active in the campaign for Roosevelt, and I really worked my head off locally in Allegheny County. In 1933, Bill McNair became the Democratic candidate for mayor. Dave Lawrence asked me whether I wanted to be a candidate for council in 1933, and I hadn't given any thought to it at all. It only paid $18,000 a year then. I wasn't sure I wanted to be a councilman. So the day before the deadline to file, I got a call from the office downtown to come down the following morning and sign the petition papers. So I went down, and then they said to hold it up, and I sat there for 2 hours while they were meeting in Senator Guffey's office in the Benedum Trees building. Then they came out, and John Houston became the candidate for council, not me. That's the only thing I hold against Dave Lawrence. He never said a word to me as to why. Later, they were sorry they ever took on John Houston. He became the Register of Wills, and he did things that caused the leaders to regret their action. But in 1937, then they asked me to be a candidate for council. I had had an interest in municipal affairs. Back when I was going to law school, I took a seminar course with the head of the political science department. He was a wonderful man at the University of Pittsburgh, and he met with me by myself once a week, and we discussed municipal government. I studied with him for 3 or 4 months. So in the 37 campaign, they suggested I go and see John Kane, because John Kane and Dave Lawrence were not close friends anymore. John Kane said to me, "No one is entitled to this more than you, the way you've always campaigned. I've promised another man, but if he's out of the picture, I certainly would support you." That was the most bitter primary in the history of any party. Not only did John Kane not support me, he had his whole ticket of 5 councilmen against us. Dave Lawrence's 5. And Pete McArdle ran for mayor against Cornelia Scully. I used to make 6 and 7 speeches a night. Well, I got nominated and I got elected. My friend Mr. Leonard was right. I gave up all my time to being a councilman. I studied everything and became an expert on municipal finance. I became very much interested in Carnegie Library. The library couldn't get anywhere with city council. When Carnegie had set up the agreement in 1895 with the city of Pittsburgh, all he did was build the buildings, but he made the city agree to give $50,000 a year to support them. By the time I was on council, it was between $300,000 and $400,000, and the library employees were treated as though they were nothing. They were not city employees. They had a board of trustees, and 7 councilmen had to be members by Carnegie's direction, and I was on it, and I knew their grievances, and I thought it was so unfair that I started to really work to build up the library system. As a matter of fact, while I'm not the one responsible for the bookmobiles, I'm the one that suggested it to Ralph Munn. I got it from Christopher Morley's book, Parnassus on Wheels, about a fellow who had a wagon and used to take books around and lend them to people. I stated, if some people won't come to the libraries, we should bring the books to them. When I left City Council, do you know what the budget was? About $1,700,000, and I got council to agree that the employees out there were to be treated exactly the same as city employees, and we gradually brought the salaries up to where they should be so we could have a first-class library system. When I became a judge, because of what I had done not only for the library, but I did work for Carnegie Institute and Carnegie Tech, Dr. Daugherty, Doherty, used to consider me his representative downtown. They made me the first life honorary trustee of those 3 institutions. I think January 1940 became the starting point of the Renaissance, as far as I'm concerned, but before that I started music in the parks. I started patriotic programs, quote, I Am an American Day, quote, which was held in Schenley Park. I started the Bill of Rights and Constitution Days. I got the Gilbert and Sullivan Group to come and give their performances on Flagstaff Hill. And I used to get up and say at intermission in a short speech that we've got to have a civic light opera like St. Louis has. Another plank in my campaign in 1937 was that we ought to have an organization like Blue Cross. Anyway, here's really the start of the Renaissance. In January 1940, while Scully was mayor, I went over to see him. We were very close. I was his representative in council. I used to have to fight for the things he wanted, like increase in water rents and so forth. So I went over to tell him, oh yes, Mrs. R. Templeton Smith was always hollering how incompetent the city was, and it should have a city manager. She used to criticize council so much. The old Pennsylvania Economy League had no effect on City Hall before Mr. Reese came and Dr. Kurtzman. Before that, all they did was criticize. They never did anything constructive. So I became in contact with Mr. Reese first and then with Dave Kurtzman. And Dave and I became very close for years. He's the one who got me to agree to do this interview. I wouldn't have done it otherwise. I used to talk to Reese and Dave, and I'd say, now listen, you got a guy in council who, while he's loyal to the Democratic Party, his first loyalty is to the people of Pittsburgh. And if I see anything that's wrong, and you tell me it's wrong, and if I agree with you, I'll do everything in my power to correct it. There doesn't have to be any criticism in the paper, because that's the worst way, because these council members are politicians. And I'm a part of a political party, but my allegiance is to the people and they know it. So that started our relationship. I went over to Scully that day to say to him that I would take a trip to Cincinnati at my own expense to find out how it was working under the city manager plan, because it was supposed to be the best run city in the United States. In the ante room before I could see Scully was his secretary, John P. Robin, and Dave Kurtzman, and Deacon Jones, the political writer for the Post-Gazette. So I was telling them what I was going to do, and they said, how about us going along? So we all went in to see Scully, and he gave us his car for the trip. So the four of us went to Cincinnati. Actually, Dave Kurtzman and I were the ones who were working together all the time, and we found out that the reason why Cincinnati changed their government was that they were the worst governed city in the United States, so anything would be better. So they adopted the city management plan. I took clippings from the newspapers on criticisms, and I found to my surprise they were similar to Pittsburgh. They had some good points. They had a low property tax because they had some other sources of income that we didn't have, and they had a joint purchasing system with the county. When I came home, I made a speech before the Hungry Club that used to meet at the Hotel Henry. The speech was called, quote, The Tale of Two Cities, quote, in which I described everything, the good points of Cincinnati, and that they had just as many faults as we had, and that I was opposed to the city manager plan. I said, if you get a good mayor, it would work better because he is elected by the people. We maintained our present system, but as a result of that trip, I tried to get joint purchasing between the various bodies. I went to the school board first because my friend Marcus Aaron was president of the board. He said, you're a good public official, but I would have to deal with the politicians, and I don't want to deal with politicians. If you were the one I had to deal with, I would go along with you, quote. So that was the end of the joint purchasing, which would have been a wonderful thing. We could get better prices. But I did put into effect something that I got out of Cincinnati. They had a better budget control system. I put into city council what they call the quarterly allotment budget control. After 3.5 years, I analyzed the effect of putting that quarterly allotment system into effect. And that's where Dave Kurtzman and the Pennsylvania Economy League were very helpful. I used the Pennsylvania Economy League as my private research bureau, and I got them close to the city of Pittsburgh, and they analyzed how much we had saved. And the savings would be recurred savings, because if I saved $250,000 one year, it did not appear in the budget the next year. The Pennsylvania Economy League then was helping to make up the budget in the future, while Scully was mayor, and then afterwards when Dave Lawrence was mayor, too. They were a tremendous help, no doubt about it. Then in 1940, I put this into effect, and Mrs. Templeton Smith always used to holler about it, and she thought well of me. And I said to her one day, "You know I'm an honest guy, and I want to do the right thing by the people of Pittsburgh. Come into my office at any time, and you tell me what you think is wrong." Quote. She always used to say this was wrong and that, but she would never point out what it was. So I said, quote, "Tell me, and I assure you I'll try to correct it." Quote. She never came to see me. The city controller at that time was a Republican, Dr. Kerr. I went down to see him. He was one of the original councilmen when it was created, and he said, quote, "I did what you did. We got too many employees. You're right. There are some political employees, some ward chairmen, but you can't help it. How much would you save altogether? You might save $200,000, but you create such a storm by doing it. And after all, we operate under a political system. So I decided not to do it, and I'm advising you not to do it too." Quote. So I didn't do anything about that until later on. I don't know what year it was. I did cut out a lot of employees. Our budget required it. Maybe some we shouldn't have, but anyway, we did. Now we come to the most important thing of the Renaissance, and I'll explain to you how it came into being. The Allegheny Conference on Community Development, which was created by Richard K. Mellon, didn't come into existence until 1943. That's after smoke control. Park Martin was the first director and a wonderful man, and they were concerned about physical improvements. I was in favor of physical improvements, but I was also in favor of the intangible things like health and so on.
Like what?